So finally, she's spent and has a nice lie down on Findulus's grave. Listen, ill health.
I think that was dead on.
Just a quick note before we get started. This episode is part 6 of the Vassals of Kingsgrave ongoing Silmarillion reread series. If you'd like to catch up on the previous episodes, they are episodes number 147, 155, 163, 172, and 182. Thank you. Enjoy. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. This is going to be the 6th part of our Silmarillion reread series. Today we will be discussing The Children of Húrin / The Tale of Túrin Túrinbar, which covers mostly chapters 20 and 21 of the Quenta Silmarillion, but also we're going to be focusing on the book as it was published in 2007 as The Children of Húrin, which is slightly edited, but it basically covers that time period. My name is Greg, and I'm joined by just one other vassal at the moment.
Hey, it's just Varley. Varley on the forms, Matt in real life.
And hopefully we'll be joined by one or several other vassals later. We've postponed a bunch of times, and we just figured we want to get it out before we forgot everything about the lovely, uplifting tale of Túrin Túrinbar.
It really is a feel-good story, isn't it?
Well, the first time I read this, it was, you know, in the context of it was just a chapter in the Silmarillion. I was like, wow, that was pretty much of a downer, but then it goes on to the destruction of the world basically right afterwards, and you're like, oh, it fits in perfectly. But when you read it on its own after reading The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings, which does have some levity, like, you realize how incredibly dark and depressing it is, but also it needs to be told because, you know, Túrin is a pretty gray character. Most characters in Tolkien, like, don't really evolve, you know, like, you got the good guys, you got your bad guys, but he's a gray character, and I really appreciate that, because there's not too many of those.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of like Beren and Lúthien flipped completely around,
yeah,
you know, but still, you know, most of the time, everyone just has, like, the normal bad guys in their sights. So, with that said, why don't we go to the big battle?
Yeah, so basically, we have to talk a little bit about Turin's father before we get to Túrin himself. So we divided the book, or the chapters, up into 6 sections, and the first section will cover a little bit of history of who Húrin's father was and his lineage, and where the story starts off. So here we go. Húrin was the grandson of the first lord of Dorlomen, Hador Goldenhead. He served Fingolfin, High King of the Noldor, until he was slain during the Dagr Bragollach. When they were young, Húrin and his brother Huor, that's H-U-O-R, were rescued from an orc party by the Eagles and brought to the hidden city of Gondolin. They dwelt there for a year until they were eventually allowed to leave, but they had to swear oaths to Turgon never to tell anyone the way to the hidden city. They returned to Dorlomen, and Húrin married Morwen of the House of Beor, and their children were Túrin, Urwin, and Nienor. Hador's descendants continued to serve the Eldar and were bannermen to King Fingon, High King of the Noldor. Túrin was a quiet and contemplative child, but quick to anger and yet also to pity. He loved his younger sister, Erwin, with all his heart, and when she died of the evil breath, a sickness sent by Morgoth, he became bitter and never spoke her name again. His only childhood friend was a servant named Sador, who was full of fortune cookie wisdom almost every time he spoke. When Túrin was 9 years old, his father left to fight in the epic 5th battle, the Nurnaeth Arnoediad, which is one of my favorite elvish names in the whole series. Took me a while to figure out, but that's how you say it. In this great battle, the combined hosts of elves and men were utterly defeated by Morgoth and were only saved from complete annihilation by Turgon opening the Leaguer of Gondolin and joining in the fight. During the battle, Húrin was taken prisoner by Morgoth and chained in his fortress of Angband. He was cursed by Morgoth to see with his eyes, so he knew all that Morgoth did in the world and to his family. No tidings or soldiers ever returned to Dorlomen after the battle, and their land was eventually taken over and occupied by the Easterlings, evil men who had betrayed the Eldar and served Morgoth during the battle.
Yeah, so...
fun times.
Oh, yeah.
During the battle, there's this epic stand of Húrin and Huar, and they're saving off everybody, and it's one of the more moving scenes in the book where he basically has this war cry that kind of has always been my favorite quote, at least in Elvish in the series, where he says, Auta ilome, aure and tuliva, which is night is passing, day shall come again. And, you know, it's this epic scene where he's slicing orcs in half and then they're attacking him again. I think he said he killed like 60 of them, but at the end, like, they were just severed arms stuck to him because he couldn't kill anymore. But they, you know, Morgoth, of course, made the big bad guy mistake of not killing him, taking him prisoner just to mess with him and to fuck with his head. And eventually that comes back to haunt him.
There's a great line, Huor says to Turgon, like, no retreat now, because from our houses, like, a star will be born. And that's just, like, looking down the road.
Yeah, because all these people know all of the dooms that are, you know, everyone's right. living under, and they're like, it's cool, there's a prophecy, we're going to be fine, or someone's going to make it out again.
Yeah, it's a... So in the book, they kind of go, they expand on Sador, don't they? Turin's father gives him a knife, and he gives it to Sador, and he's like, well, you shouldn't have given me this. He's like, well, it was mine to give. Like, I'm open-handed like that, which is kind of nice. And that just speaks to his pity, because Sador, like, way to injure himself, like, either chopping wood or in a battle or something.
Yeah, I always kind of liked, I didn't know if that was Tolkien's way of, you know... talking about the soldiers who weren't wounded in battle and didn't have the glory, you know, to stand upon. But he basically, like, was chopping a tree down and cut his hand or cut his leg, and he could never fight again. But he's full of all these little bits of wisdom, and I think that that's kind of like, you know, I feel like in Lord of the Rings, Gandalf was Tolkien inserting himself into the story a little bit with his quotes and with his aphorisms, and in this story, it's definitely through Sador that he does that.
But wouldn't that be kind of allegory?
No, not necessarily. He didn't do allegory. Didn't mean he didn't put himself in the story, though. Yeah, he said, give with a free hand, but give only your own. So he made him give the knife back and save it for another day.
Yeah, so...
I just felt so bad for him, because he's like a 9-year-old kid, and his only friend is like a 40-year-old household servant, you know? He's like, I've got a friend, I gave him a knife, love me.
Wait, yeah. He made him give it back?
Hey!
Oh, hey, Bryce. Didn't he give the knife back? Yeah, he gave the knife back.
No, he tried to give it back to him, and Turin was like, no, I don't want it. It's for you, I gave it to you. And then he started carving the chair.
Oh, I forget. I read this like 3 months ago. Thank you.
Oh, so did I. So did I. I'm pretty sure that's what Sador was carving. He was going to carve like a chair for Hurin.
Oh, for Hurin, that's right. I remember that.
And then it just ended up kindling in the corner because right. Sador.
And then he didn't give the knife back because it was his. It was fine. I edited that. That sounds great.
Good job.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So welcome.
Sorry, Brad. I was late, guys.
No, we just started like 5 minutes ago. That's cool. I'm glad we have someone else. Did you want to talk a little bit about the fifth battle? Any comments of Hurin and his epic last stand?
Oh, yeah. I loved how, like, the orc hands were just hanging off him, but he just kept chopping away.
How many more do I have to kill?
Well, if they would have let him just kill him, probably wouldn't have taken somebody with him, but yeah. Morgoth doesn't give a shit. He's like, as many as it takes to subdue him.
Yeah, so I kind of wrote in the show notes, and Greg commented on this, that Uri and Tuluva is probably on the top three of my next ideas for tattoo. Another one being a hurricane lamp and the Doors of Durin.
Oh, Doors of Durin is so overdone. Go with this one.
Wait, a hurricane lamp?
Yeah, I have a whole nautical theme on my right arm, so.
Oh, is there a narwhal there yet?
Not yet.
There fucking should be.
Why? So I could just give myself dead arms all the time?
You're right. Put it on your knee. Oh, wait, put it right on your pelvis and have... Never mind, I won't finish that. And you can just beat that narwhal all the time.
And we're in the after show already. Thanks, Brett.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys.
No, it's fine.
What are we even talking about anyway?
We're about to get to Turin. We're still talking about how nice and awesome his dad is before we get how depressing Turin is.
His dad's life is pretty depressing. Sorry, we'll get to that.
Well, everyone in this world is depressing because they're all living under dooms and prophecies and... They're like the third generation ever of humans, so they're like, we gotta keep up appearances. You know, there's no like, you know, then the Easterlings come in and cause all sorts of trouble, but...
I feel like this whole thing is like the elves being like, see, people suck. And then they like throw in a little like Hurin bit, they're like, see, he was awesome, but everybody else sucks. They're like, Beren took Lúthien away, and look at what Turin's doing. Sad. Good thing we got Tuor, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, Tuor
really
does. Not
much in this story,
does...
though, but he comes in, he plays an important part later.
The elves are like, look how shitty humans' lives are. Ha ha.
But the whole world is basically saved by a human, so that works out.
No, it's a hobbit.
No, I'm talking about Arendil.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he's half elf.
He's halfy, though.
You can't have half a human without a human, right? He's human. He didn't live forever.
That doesn't make any sense.
He's like Elros. He's human, even though he was technically half, you know, half elven.
All right. Sorry, derailed us.
Turin didn't have the happiest childhood. Morgoth kind of killed his sister with, like, a evil version of tuberculosis, it seems. And after that, he got even more depressed and never spoke her name ever again.
Can it just be tuberculosis?
Well, it said it was, like, it was an evil wind sent from the east, so I assume it's it was something sent by, you know, like, his volcanoes or something. I don't know.
Volcanoes give tuberculosis? Science.
He said on an asbestos cloud, it's just mesothelioma, and they all died.
Jesus.
So we do get the epic fifth battle, which does have a lot of very important stuff that goes down. At one point, it looks like things are going, you know, the we'll call it the Allied's way. But then there's the Easterlings defect from Maedhros' forces.
Yeah, Ulfang or something.
Yeah, I mean, how do you not know a guy named Ulfang, the Accursed?
Right?
The Accursed.
I assume that cognomen wasn't, everyone didn't know that yet.
It was after, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, don't forget Morgoth forcing the elves to prematurely fight with... like dismembering Gwyndor's brother.
Oh yeah, no, that was that.
Oh,
that, Gelmir, yeah.
Gelmir.
Yeah, that was
That's one of the few. I mean, there's a lot of scenes that are kind of burned into my head, but like I can actually picture like this whole host of elves, like you know, because they had the high ground, they were in a good position, and then like they just bring them out and start hacking them to pieces, and they just go freaking crazy and charge down. Like that's something I would like Peter Jackson to do, just that one scene, just so I can see that, and then like a short film, like just do the battles.
Or you could do that one scene over the course of three films.
Like no one complains about how awesome the Battle of Pelennor Fields is, you know. So if he got, you know, if Christopher Tolkien was like, all right, you can just do the battles.
I disagree. Some people do.
Some people do, but like no one doesn't freaking feel it when you have Theoden's speech and the Red Dawn and all that. So.
That part's okay, but when they're just like, "Hey, bring in those ghost things," and they'll just clean everything up.
Yeah, no. All right. So the first two thirds are all right.
Yeah.
But you get the epic duel of Fingon and Gothmog, and Gothmog is also the only other bad guy name that Tolkien ever came up with for Balrog and sub-commanders. Like, it's just Gothmog. So maybe it's just like the Bob of Angband's names. We have Glaurung shows up. You know, the first time he came out, like, he was like a baby dragon, and they fought him off, and that's where Hurin actually got his dragon helm, or his grandfather did. Because he fought off the dragon, but now he's in his full fury.
I thought the dwarves fought him off.
The dwarves fought him off in this one a little bit, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I think the dwarves, like, basically made him run from the field, and then, what's his name, their king guy dies, and then the dwarves just carry him off the field, and nobody even touches them, they just let him leave.
That's,
like,
yeah, that
the
was
the orcs don't even fight him. That was fight, right?
And the two battles ago, when he first came out, it was, I believe it was Hador.
Oh, that was two battles ago. Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's because he was called Hurin with the Dragon Helm, which is, like, basically their ancestral, you know, thingy that passes down through the generations.
I get
which is
battle.
Pretty cool on the cover of The Children of Hurin.
Yeah. They make him look a little more, like, lizard-like, and basically Turgon, you know, comes out of hiding and to rescue the prevent a complete rout, but he doesn't actually beat anybody, but he lets Hurin lets him escape, and that's when he goes down fighting. So that's kind of all the stuff that goes down in the fifth battle, and then Morgoth occupies his home, Turin's homelands.
Mm-hmm. With a whole bunch of just losers.
Yeah, you guys get the shittiest lands ever.
But they weren't able to get, like, the full alliance because, what, Nargothrond was like, hey, remember Beren and Luthien and how Curufin was a dick to everyone? Like, we're not going out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Doriath didn't really play a part either, which they never really do. So that's basically the jumping off point for the story. And Turin is growing up in the shadow of his father never came home. Easterlings move in. His mother is kind of displaced as the lady of the land, but she's still sort of awesome to behold, and they're terrified of her, so they don't mess with her too much. But still, it's not a happy childhood by any means.
Yeah, they like call her a witch and stuff.
Yeah, they think so.
As a counter to Hurin's last words, their battle cry was like, the night's coming or the day's breaking or something like that. That was pretty badass.
Flame, Laco Chalad Dregamorn, flame light, yeah. Flea night. Yeah,
exactly. See, I think that's all I got.
The good guys usually have the good battle cries, but we never get the orcish battle cries. They could be just as badass. We just don't know. I'm sure they don't roll off the tongue as well, though.
Grond, Grond, or whatever it was.
They're like, let's rip his fucking arms off.
Section 2, Turin's departure from Dor Lomond and Turin in Doriath.
Okay, so after the fifth battle, the Easterlings came to Dor Lomond and occupied the land. Their chieftain, Broda, took Lady Arryn, a noblewoman of Dor Lomond, to wife and ruled from a newly built stronghold. He left Morwen alone and did not harm her, since he feared her greatly and her rumored powers. The Easterlings made thralls of the people of Hurin, and eventually Morwen convinced young Turin to leave before further evil befell him. Turin's journeys to the kingdom of Doriath, where Morwen told him that King Thingol would accept him and protect him, since he is related to Beren through his mother. Thingol accepts Turin and is actually pretty nice to him and even jokes with him a little bit. Turin joins Thingol's household and is watched over by the elf Nellis, who, even when he doesn't know it, yeah, she's a total creeper. He grows up tall and strong into a great warrior. Turin becomes a captain in Thingol's army and is held in great regard along with Beleg and Malblung, two other captains of Doriath. Turin pisses off an elf named Serios.
Serios?
Sure. Because he sat in his seat by accident. Serios tries to stab Turin, which is, you know, completely proportional. And this leads to an epic rap battle of Doriath that ends with Turin chasing Saros off a cliff to his death. Turin believes that Thingol will hold him responsible, even though it was Saros' fault. He decides to flee Doriath. Thingol eventually clears Turin of any wrongdoing because the creeper told him the whole thing, but Turin has already left. Beleg decides to go and search for Turin and attempt to bring him back to Doriath. Before he departs, he chooses the blade Anglekel from Thingol's armory, a black blade forged by the dark elf Eol.
We'll remember how well Eol did.
Yeah, he got his ass tough like a penguin.
Yeah, this is just like the first of many misunderstandings, or just like Turin deciding not to try to talk it out, you know, just, and he just makes one bet. I assume they're going to go the other way, so I'm just going to run away. And like, this is literally, if he would have stayed, like, he never would have been in the places for all the other crap to happen, and we wouldn't have had a story, but it had to happen, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he does just overreact and then calls himself something else.
Yes, and that's the other, we have to note how many names Turin has. I believe he has 13 throughout the entire story, but at this point, I believe he's been Turin, and, oh, he has 9, yeah. He hasn't renamed his name yet, but he will shortly. Yeah, so he gets to hang out in Doriath for a while, become pretty, you know, that's where he gets trained, all the training montage by all the epic elves, and learns to use the blade and the bow. But he does not wear his father's helm because he's, like, shamed and does not, you know, think himself worthy to be his father's heir yet.
Like that, like, the Saros guy is picking on him about his people and how, like, the women must run around naked like deer, and he just doesn't even say anything, he just throws his goblet off the guy's face.
Yeah, there's also a theme in the book of Dicky Elvish minstrels, because wasn't there one in Doriath? Another one in Doriath? Or was that in Gondolin, who, like, Arathel, like, was pissing off Arathel? Oh, no, that might have been... It's been so long since I read the first half of the book. Do you know who I'm thinking about?
Oh,
was that in Doriath also? It was the other guy who was in love with Luthien, right?
Yeah.
And he, like, caused trouble
but
for
But she
Turin.
Loved him not.
Right. Okay. Yeah, but I was surprised how nice Turin was. Like, he actually joked with him at one point, and he was like, oh, yeah, sure, I love men now, it's cool. My son-in-law was a man, it's all right. From where he was before, like, the dickiest king in the world, and was like, men suck, humans suck, don't touch me.
Don't ever come into my land.
Yeah. He says, here, son of Húrin, shall be your home, and in all your life you shall be held as my son. Man though you be, dwell now here in love. I can see...
Aww.
That's just very nice, but it seems like something more that Melian would say.
Turin is just dying for kids, but... Yeah. Can, like, Melian only make one child? Is that what the deal is? Or is it just, like...
At this point, Beren and Luthien are, like, out living in the far east, right? Or far east, right? They came back, but they're not really in the story yet.
No, I think in the beginning of the Five Battle chapter, it says that they've already passed and they live in the land of those that do not die.
Yeah, but no, don't they have to come back? Because after Doriath falls, Beren kills, like, the dwarves when they're spoiler alert. But right, isn't Beren the one that, like, kills the head dwarf when he's trying to steal the Nauglamir and all that?
No, I think that was Tur.
No, that's Tur.
Is it Tur?
No, it's Húrin.
It's Húrin, yeah.
Yeah, because after, like...
Húrin comes back, and...
Yeah, and
Morwen,
like,
kills herself,
fucking,
or dies.
Yeah, you let my entire family die, and Thingol's like, I did everything I could, and he feels like a dick, so he goes out and Nargothrond kills Nim.
No, I mean, after Turgon's dead, and the dwarves are, like, running out of Doriath, isn't it Beren that kills them when they're trying to get back to, like, the Blue Mountains and shit?
I don't think so.
Am I completely making that up?
I think you're making it up, man.
Oh, man.
I think you're full of lies.
All right. I was just testing you guys.
I was just testing you guys the whole time.
Okay, that can we edit, like, the last, like, 5 minutes?
Melian tells Beleg that sword will be his undoing, basically. I forget what her exact words were, but she's like, they do not. The old elf spirit still lies within the sword.
Yeah, the heart of the elf, like, lies in the sword, yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yes. Also, they don't know that it's a talking sword yet. I mean, I would never use a talking sword. That seems like a bad idea.
Well, it never talks until Turin has it. I think Turin's just batshit crazy at the end. Wouldn't you be after that shit went down? You're like, no.
No, he just pulls it out, and it's like the singing sword from Roger Rabbit.
God. Now I think of it completely differently. But yeah, but You're Turin welcome. Is basically, his reputation is saved by the elf stalker who may or may not have been in love with him as a small child, which is a little weird. Or maybe she was just like the nice wood sprite that watched over him. I don't know.
It's so weird that elves love him and he's just like, yeah, whatever, like humans. He's very emo about it.
Yeah. No, when he'd be like, I love elves because they're older, like I was the first one to love them, if he was like emo.
Wait, what?
Or is it that just be like hipster?
No, he's like, I'm like the first guy to not love elves. They're so last week. I just love humans.
Who doesn't?
This chapter also has the only buttocks reference in all of Tolkien's literature when you mention Saris's buttocks.
Oh, yeah, when he's poking him.
Yeah. I mean, there's no, we don't see any of the naughty bits in Tolkien at all, but this is very postmodern for Tolkien. When Nellis came in and said, oh, I walk in the forest, oh my king, and he's like, that's cool, others have done this, but have felt no need to tell me of it. I just picture Tolkien, like, lighting his pipe and chuckling nicely. And
giggling to himself.
That was a good one.
Oh, witty.
Basically, he had a couple good years, you know, got his training done, and ran away from the only people that have ever really loved him.
It's so weird how quickly, like, men train in this world. It's like, he starts out, what is he, like 15? And he's like 17. He's like, yeah, he's fully trained, better than any elf warrior. How shitty are the elves?
Well, they go slower. I mean, we never really see many elvish kids. I don't think we ever see elvish kids.
No, but they kind of talk about it a little bit. It might be in the children.
Turin went to the DeVry Institute of Elf Training, just like Luke Skywalker went to the DeVry Institute of Jedi.
Institute.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, it's just interesting. Like, it seems like men train like no time at all.
It also seems that the elves are like always impressed by how like strong men, because they're, you know, you think of elves, you think of like thin, wispy, but they're still badass with blades and stuff. But like, and he was like a king among men, and he looked like any strong dwarf. You know, it seemed like are there no strong elves? Like Beleg, I assume, is a strong dude. You know, he can
Mablung, yeah,
all those guys.
I don't know. Maybe it's just that the men that we hear about are just the creme de la creme.
That's true.
Well, I feel like it could also be something like, you know, you don't think of like. Like, Tolkien kind of described the elves as, like, the angels. So, like, you don't think of, like, Michael the Archangel as, like, fucking Sylvester Stallone, like, wielding a sword. No.
Have you seen some of the paintings of angels over the years? Or they are Diablo? There's some pretty buff-looking angels out there.
But, I mean, angels have an excuse. They have to fly.
That's true.
Flying increases your metabolism. Of course you're going to have a six-pack.
Moving on to Turin among his merry outlaw band, and we meet one of my favorite characters in the book, Mim the Petty Dwarf.
After departing Doriath, Turin is caught by a band of outlaws. One of the outlaws tries to shoot Turin, but he evades the arrow, and then Turin hurls a stone at him, killing him. This means he passed the outlaw entry exam, and he becomes one of the outlaws. He names himself Nathan, which means the wronged. A little later on, Turin rescues a woman who is fleeing from a few outlaws. Turin kills Forweg, the captain of the outlaws, without really knowing who he was, since he was just saw him chasing a woman. The outlaws have a choosing, and since a large portion of them were exiles from the House of Hador, they side with Turin and choose him and help the rest vote Turin in for the new captain. Did he tell them who he was?
No, but they knew he was like a man of the House of Hador, I believe.
Why? House of Hador were all blonde. Turin was black hair.
I don't know. They knew who he was. Otherwise, they wouldn't have voted for him. Or they knew he was might have been a friend of theirs.
Well, he beat the shit out of their captain and killed some other dude. They're like, yeah, you're good. You're the winner.
That's how it works. That's how you rise in the outlaw band, except for Robin Hood, where you just sing songs.
I don't know if it was because he was from the House of Hador. I believe you. It just sounds crazy.
I think they mentioned that at one point, that it was because they knew him for a man of the, you know, of the Edain or, you know, they're one of the good men.
So we're reading a fake history of elves, and that sounds crazy?
Yep. All right. Turin trades the outlaws to attack orcs instead of raiding farms, and they become orcs feared among the forces of Morgoth. Meanwhile, back in Doriath, Thingol had sent messengers to find Turin and bring him news of his acquittal and to recall him back to Doriath. Beleg has been sent to find Turin, and he follows the trail of the outlaws over many leagues. Eventually, Beleg catches up to the outlaws, but Turin is away. The outlaws tie him to a tree and starve him for the next few days before Turin comes back. When he does, he frees Beleg, and Turin learns of his pardon and summons to Doriath. But Turin decides not to return, but to remain with the outlaws to fight Morgoth openly instead of only defending their lands. Beleg returns to Doriath and is rewarded for finding Turin by Thingol and Melian with a gift of Lemba spread.
We can discuss that chunk, because it's like six chapters and Brett's having a tough time. I apologize, that's not the best copy there, but I was putting these notes together pretty fast.
Three months ago,
when I thought we were recording.
Don't blame yourself, because I can't read. That's not
right.
Fair.
I will never use the term later on to confuse you ever again.
It's not a Vermonter term.
So Turin finds himself Robin Hood, king of the outlaws, and he is sort of training them to fight orcs instead of raiding little farms, which I thought I appreciated. But of course, this puts them back on the radar for Morgoth. Morgoth thinks he's, you know, beat basically everybody except for Turgon and Nargothrond, and now he realizes that there's this other guy he's got to deal with down south.
Yeah,
and he's named Nathan.
Yeah.
Some guy named Nathan is causing him trouble.
Have you ever met a Nathan that hasn't caused trouble?
Nathan Hale caused some trouble. He's the only Nathan I know, like, historically. I don't know many Nathans.
Hey, he's
Nathan
from Killian. Connecticut, too. Booyah.
Great. So, I don't know. I think it's strange that Turin just... He seems to, like, be taken for a leader everywhere he goes. Like, I guess he's been trained, and none of these outlaws have been trained, so clearly he's the best fighter among them, and they're like, yeah, you're the captain, because we don't want to fight you. Like, when he kills that one guy with the stone, and then he's like, what do you think? And the other guy's like, yeah, you can be part of the group.
Yeah. Some people just have that, you know, that cult of personality, or that, you know, just aura that just exudes confidence and leadership skills. You know, I've met a couple people like that in my life, and you just will listen to anything they say and just be like, oh, wow, that makes sense. You're in charge. You know, that's also how cults start. So, but also, you see this guy who's obviously, you know, very well trained, has these amazing weapons, knows how to use them. Like, you're going to listen to that guy, especially in a group of people that's what they do.
Also, not all that glitters is gold or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And they don't all have blonde hair, so it's okay to have some dark-haired heroes.
Yeah, I think it's just more that is like prowess. Like, when you guys were talking about, sorry, I was having a cigarette. When you guys were talking about, how they just, like, recognize him as, like, a man of Hador's house. Like, I think, you know, you could probably, like, recognize, like, a linebacker by his build, too, you know?
Are you from the House of Linebacker?
So that's basically the first section of his little fun time among the outlaws. Then we move on to... I can read the second recap if you want, unless you want to keep reading.
Well, I did practice, but no, you can go ahead, because... I'm retarded.
No, you're not. But anyway.
I'm a new adult. I read at a third grade level.
I know. Yeah, but also we get the mention of Lembas Bread, which is pretty nice. That's how Beleg keeps himself going on the long roads to finding Turin again. And of course, when he finds him again, oh my god, I found you. I'm not coming with you. But you can stay with me if you want.
Which I don't know if they mention in Fellowship of the Ring, but like they say here, it's like only the Queen of the Elves can gift this. So that was like a big thing that Galadriel did that.
I mean, I think we're meant to realize it's a gift. Like, they don't do that for everybody. I think they say that more in the movie than in the books, where never have we, you know, given this to people who aren't of our own people. But that might have been a close.
I think it says, like, seldom or something like that.
Well, I think, like, maybe in Children of Hurin, where they expand on it a little bit, like, they say, like, only the queen does this and only, like, very seldom, which is nice.
Yeah. It pays off, keeps them going in their tough times. They don't have time to grow food yet, and they haven't discovered potatoes. They get the potatoes in the next chapter.
Right. I think Gwyndor really appreciates it.
Yeah.
So did anyone think Beleg was, like, more badass than to get jacked up by a bunch of fucking highwaymen?
It seemed that he let him be taken. Like, he didn't fight back.
Yeah.
But it didn't
seem like a stupid move.
Yeah.
He's like, hello, friends of Turin. And they're like, who the fuck is this guy? Tie him down. He's like, okay. Like, don't feed him. He's like, all right, I ate a half of Lembas bread the other day. I'm good.
Yeah, he probably also didn't. He probably didn't expect to be taken by non-orcs. Like, he assumes that orcs are the bad guys. Like, oh, men are cool. They fight with us. Okay, what are you guys doing? You know, something like that. Moving on to the second half. One day, when the outlaws are out outlawing, they find three dwarves. Naturally, they shoot at them first without asking questions, wounding one and capturing one. It is Mim, the petty dwarf. He is grumpy and kind of nasty, and well, I'll just say it, he's a petty dwarf. Turin takes him prisoner and puts him in chains, which really pisses him off. This is also one of my favorite little scenes where, like, he gets quiet when they put the cuffs. Yeah. He's like, fuck you, you don't put cuffs on me. He then forces Mim to take them to his home, since the outlaws need a place to stay for the winter. Mim reluctantly agrees and leads them to Amon-Ruth, his hilltop secret hideaway with a commanding view of the guarded plain. This basically is between Nargothrond and the Forest of Brethel, which commands, like, a big open area that anybody trying to get to Nargothrond is going to have to cross over. He leads them through secret ways inside, where they find Mim's two sons. One has died from his arrow wound. Mim then swears vengeance upon the outlaws and curses Androg, who shot his son. Mim and the outlaws reach an unquiet detente and settle down for the winter. Mim tells the outlaws about the magic of potatoes, and they are like, whoa. After several months, Beleg returns to the outlaws and saves them from starving with his gifts of Lembas. He then decides that if he can't convince Turin to return to Doriath, then he will join Turin and his merry band. He gives Turin the dragon helm of Dor Lomond, and together they form the ultimate wrecking crew, and the orc raiding parties are all... aw, shit. So this is where they start really wreaking havoc on the orcs around them, and Morgoth is paying attention.
I'm genuinely curious, so don't... don't think I'm just like picking on him, but do you think like Beleg, when they talk about his love for Horan, do you think it's like John Connington love or like Band of Brothers type of love? Because we don't meet Miss Strongbow.
I think that's a good question. I mean, there's always the jokes about Sam and Frodo, you know, but that's, I mean, the relationship of like a bagman to his officer in the First World War was always a very close relationship and doing stuff for them. But this does seem to be a more like he genuinely loves him. He's out trying to find him. It's not I owe you anything, you know.
Yeah,
it's possible. But I mean, I don't think probably not.
Well, maybe I don't think it's necessarily. It's kind of like Finduilis's love for him that like he doesn't return it, but you know, there's something there.
No, my gaydar did not go off on Beleg too much. I mean, I didn't even pick up on John Connington until I was reading about it, you know, on my second reread. So I, yeah, not all gay guys have good gaydar, I guess.
Yeah, I think Tolkien uses love not in the sexual manner, like
ever.
You know, ever. It's like at that moment he loved him. It's like, no, they didn't. It's like sack up.
No, it's also, it's just his, it was his job, it was his role, you know, it was his duty that his king, you know, laid upon him, was to find him, bring him back, and that's what he went to great lengths to do. You know, he never turned around. Even when he finally got him, he basically joins up with him rather than going back empty-handed again. But I the character of Mim kind of, like, didn't seem to fit for me. Like, he was this almost, like, comical, you know.
Curmudgeon?
Yeah, this little, like, grumpy guy, like, he had all these off lines, and it just didn't seem to fit in the greater story. I mean, it pays off, you know, where he betrays them and everything, but he has this line where he, you know, Androg is the guy that kills his son, and he has this instant hatred for him, understandably. But, you know, the fact that he works with the orcs to betray them just bothered me. You know, I wouldn't picture a dwarf actually doing that.
Right, because that's the only thing they hate more than everything else is orcs. Yeah. I don't. But then again, if he's, like, bargaining for his life, I don't know.
Yeah, he did have the good line about calling him, "You are one of the fools that spring would not mourn if you perished in winter." So he knew a good seasonal insult, at least.
Yeah, so he teaches them roots and potatoes.
They're like, "You can eat this stuff? You can what? We didn't know about this."
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that him and Turin are like buddy-buddy until Beleg shows up, and then he's like, "Talk to elves? Fuck you." And they like just stops talking to him. Turin's like, "I don't care," because he's so lost in his own world all the time.
Yeah, but he's given up on getting him to go back, so we just get the land of Bow and Helm, which is the big, you know, that's the big montage scene where they're just like cut scenes of this and that, and they're taking them and kicking asses and all.
Bow and Helm kind of sounds gay.
All right. No, well, I was about to say, but yeah, okay. It's not sword and bow or sword and sword. If it was the land of sword and sword, that would be a big red flag.
The land of tummy sticks.
Do you think Beleg might love him because he gives with a free hand?
But only his own. Only his own.
He comes from a generous kin.
All right, let's get it all out now.
Sorry.
He's about to meet his elvish girlfriend. Come on, let's not. We don't want this.
He doesn't have an elvish girlfriend. He has an elvish admirer.
All right.
Elvish beard.
So, yeah, so Morgoth is pissed off, and meanwhile, all this is going on, and Nargothrond, which never really has taken part in the wars yet, is basically like, hey, this guy's here, he's causing trouble, some of them want to join up with him, but it's not until Turin actually gets to Nargothrond that he sort of does to the Nargothronians what he did to the outlaws. But before that, we have to get the fall of the outlaw band. So, if Matt, would you like to read the next recap, or do you want me to do it, or...
Yeah, I could do it.
All right, we'll just alternate till the end. It's fine.
Eh.
Or not. I don't think it says later on anymore, so don't worry.
All right.
Okay, so Beleg joins Turin and his outlaw company, and along with Turin, they begin openly to defy Morgoth's forces. They clear the land between Norgothrond, I'm pretty sure that was misspelled there, and Brethil of orcs, and keep a watch on the area. All right, Brett, I understand.
Eventually, Morgoth lays siege to their stronghold. Oh, we're not switching every sentence?
Yeah, no, go ahead. I like that. Go ahead. Alternate sentences.
Eventually, Morgoth lays siege to their stronghold on Amon Ru, and through the treachery of Mim the Petty Dwarf, the orcs slay all of Turin's band, but left Beleg tied and bound for Mim as per their agreement with Mim.
What?
What?
Who typed these?
I did.
Notes.
I'm sorry. What did I do?
I feel like that's a run-on sentence. I talked a lot just there.
It gets the information out. It's all right.
It did. So basically, they tie him up so Mim can...
Mim betrayed them, but he's like, you leave Beleg for me. So they left him, because orcs...
I like to beat on elves, because I'm a dick.
God damn.
Now I'm just picturing a dwarf beating Beleg, like, meh. So, all right, we'll get past that.
Does Baelag have a Norwal tattoo?
Bringing it all back around.
Oh, God.
Androch was mortally wounded, attacked Mim, drove him off, and then freed Baelag from dying. Turin was taken prisoner by the orcs. Baelag tracked the orc company to the far north of Beleriand, and there found the elf Gwyndor, a survivor of the near...
Good luck.
Nirnaeth Arnoediad.
Nirnaeth Arnoediad.
Thank you. Wounded and near death from torture, Baelag... Oh, well, that's the end of this. Baelag nursed him back to health, and together they find the orcs who have taken Turin. You think it's... Gwyndor, it's strange that he comes back into the story to me.
Yeah, that was... I feel like that's something like, oh yeah, I mentioned him early on. He's got to come back now. How about we'll just find him dying next to a tree?
I feel like he was just writing, and he was like, and he met an elf. Let's name him Gwyndor. Shit, I already named one that. Nah, fuck it. It's the same guy. He did it with... what's his name? Glorfindel.
Which blew my mind when I found out about that. Yeah, same guy? What?
Baelag nursed him back to health, and together they find the orcs who have taken Turin. During a heavy storm, they free Turin, but in his fear and delirium, Turin thinks Baelag is trying to kill him when he cuts his bonds. Turin kills Baelag with his own sword and then freaks out after he realizes what he has done. Turin and Gwyndor return to Nargothrond, where Gwyndor was once a lord of that city. Turin takes up service in the defense of Nargothrond, falls in love with Fwendwila's, Gwyndor's old fiance?
Yeah.
He doesn't fall in love with her.
She falls in love with him, right?
Yeah, that is not the same thing.
Oh, right.
I would have had a lot more girlfriends if that was the case. And rises high in the service of King Orodreth. Baelag's sword, Girthang, is reforged. Isn't it the other way around? Baelag's sword, Anglicel, is reforged as Girthang.
You know what? Right. Screw you guys. Right. I'm going home.
You are at home. Don't lie.
I know.
But that's right, right?
Yeah. It's the other way around.
All right. You don't have to retype it. I just got it across. Now you're just fucking with me.
Sorry.
After several years, Curdin the Shipwright sends emissaries to Nargothrond, warning them of its imminent fall and urges them to flee. Turin urges the folk to ignore them. Soon, Glaurung returns with a large orc host and attacks Nargothrond. Pretty much everyone is killed or enslaved. Glaurung puts Turin under a freezing spell so he can't move and he is forced to watch while Fwendwillis is taken prisoner and marched away. Glaurung messes with Turin's head and tells him that his mother and sister are in Dol Omen if he wants to find them. He eventually releases Turin from his spell, and Turin hastens to his old home to save his family.
Yeah, so this is our first example of a dragon just fucking with people because it needs something to do. Because
it's fun.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Oh, but you left Christ. Out how Turin, like, went mute for a while, and then Gwyndor, like nurses him back to health.
I mentioned the freezing spell, right?
No, but...
Oh, that doesn't happen after yet. Turin... That's when they go to I don't know. I made these so long ago. I was rushing.
No, but that's why I was like saying, like, you know, the whole A-Rod like thing where it's like Turin kills Baelag, like, so he fucks up. He has to go through a year of suspension and then comes back hard. Like, yeah.
Yeah, after he kills Baelag, he's like mute for a while, and Gwyndor nurses him back to health, and that's when they go back to Nargothrond,
okay,
right?
So they did spend some time in the wild before actually going back, that's right.
Yeah, and he's like, dude, what happened to your hand? And he's like, oh, fucking lost it.
Yes.
What?
Gwyndor's missing a hand, right?
Yeah, he got it cut off in the battle. Being tortured.
Aren't they, like, by the lake, like, Nevrast, and see, like, Tuor, like, walking in the opposite direction, and, like, we're like, oh, look at that guy.
Yeah, and he never comes back. I don't even know if they mention it, or they mention it in one version, and then it's not by name. You just see someone, and then when you read Tuor's story later, you're like, oh, that was them.
Yeah. Right?
Do they even talk about it in Children of Fëanor?
They don't mention Tuor. They don't mention, because it's kind of going on concurrently, but they don't mention it in the book, I don't think.
Okay.
There is the painting that Ted Naismith does, where it shows them at like the Pools of Ivern, and you see a guy with like a flaming sword on the other side of the lake. You're like, wonder what the hell that was.
Oh, I've never seen that.
Yeah, it's in the Illustrated Silmarillion.
That must be Stannis.
Yeah. But the painting of Gwyndor, it's on page 211 of the Illustrated Edition, if anyone has it. Mess with my head so much, because first off, I think, Brett, you said this, like, Gwyndor looks like a woman, so I was like, oh, this is a female elf. And also, he's got two hands. He should have one hand, which always messed with me. Like, how does the artist not pick up on that and draw him accurately? That always
bothers me. And Turin's wearing, like, a... Turin's wearing a scabbard. It just seems weird. He's got like a scabbard on his hip. He was tied
for
up.
A sword that wasn't there.
There's a sword. It's in the ground right next to Baelag, but yeah. He wouldn't have had a sword. Like, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't have tied him up with a scabbard on. I don't know. It's just another weapon he would have.
Yeah, it's artistic interpretation, but it just always bothered me. The first, I was like, oh, he's got two hands, damn it. But didn't want Baelag to go out so early.
And he's got a heavy breast.
It does look like he's got
That's fine. He could just be a dude with heavy breasts. I don't know what elves look like.
Maybe he's, you know, like a badass woman elf, and they're like, "You're a lady, you can't fight." You know, he's like, I'm a man now." You know, like women fought in the Civil War just dressed up as men.
Gwyndor kind of it kind of sounds like an eagle's name.
Well, because of Gwaihir, the Wind Lord.
Well, it just sounds. What does it mean? Dor would be like land, right? So what would Gwyn mean? Must mean something, is it?
To the glossary.
Sure.
What are we looking for? Dor?
Gwyndor? No, Dor is land.
Dor is land. There's no Gwy. There's Gwath, which is shadow, and Gwaith, which is people. No Gwyn.
Maybe he's people land.
Yeah. Let's not get bogged.
In the show notes, we didn't discuss that Turns like was accepted in Nargothrond, and his pride was like, no, we'll build a big bridge. So like...
Oh, yeah.
You know, everyone can get out and attack the orcs, and the big bridge was what was able to let the dragon in and all the orcs.
Yeah, they have their big Saving Private Ryan moment with, like, destroy the bridge. No, we can't. And it doesn't blow up, and then the Nazis get over and take Finduilus.
It's funny, because, like, certain, like, Curdan, like, writes, or has the guy deliver the message to the, it's like the master of Nargothrond, which is Orodreth, but it is talking to Turin specifically.
Yeah.
Right.
It's so weird. It's like he knows that Turin's in charge there, even though it's Orodreth.
I mean, he is in charge, but he's the backbone of the city. It seems like he's like pushed Gwyndor out of that role. You know, he's bitter at him because he kind of his girlfriend fell in love with him, and also he's like taking his job also.
Well, Gwyndor lost his job when he broke rank like a douche. So,
but I did like. I mean, I don't get like when the I liked it when the emissary showed up. Like, hey, we're elves. You know, we have the second sight. We know this shit's going down. Come to us. We got a big walled city. We got ships. And Turin's like, no, let's build a bridge. Okay, we're going to go with what that guy says.
And then he, like, accuses them of not being brave. And they're like, we'd stay and fight right now, but we got to go back, so...
And that's how Curdan makes it to be 8,000 years old by the end of Return of the King, because he makes sound decisions and has people that follow his
words. Well, you say sound decisions, but he sits, like, behind three leaguers that just sit there all the time. All right. Well,
sounds like
enough.
A pussy.
He's got books to read and shit. He's got ships to build. It's fine.
He's trying to grow a beard.
I know. At this point, he's got like a little fuzz, maybe. We don't know.
So, yeah. This is the first time Glaurung messes with someone's head in the story.
And, of course, after seeing the Hobbit movies, now I think of Benedict Cumberbatch when I hear Glaurung speaking. But the voice that Christopher Lee does in the audiobook is really great. He does an awesome Glaurung.
Do you guys think that Smaug is more powerful than Glaurung?
No.
Well,
no?
It's weird because Glaurung apparently is like too fat to fly. Like he just crawls everywhere.
He doesn't even have wings.
Big belly. He doesn't have wings. He's got to have wings.
No. They call him like a worm, and they don't.
Well, I think that's because he crawls like when he's, you know, feasted and everything. But in the first battles, they say he like issued forth, and he definitely had to have wings. Is it dragon?
He didn't have wings. No, he doesn't have wings. Dragons don't have wings yet.
What?
No way.
They developed that. Yeah, I'm serious.
Stop it.
He's like a giant lizard. I'm not fucking with
you. No, I know he's always presented as a giant lizard in this book. Like, he's always crawling on the ground.
Because he doesn't have wings. Ooh, I'm telling you. Wings come later on. Because he like, releases them later on, and it's like they didn't even know he had flying dragons.
All right, time out. We're going to have a little sidebar.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, I'm just going to go read the wiki.
All right.
But in the first battle, the dragons first issued, they were flying.
No, he is the first dragon.
Unnumbered ashes or whatever.
Numbered tears?
Sure.
All right.
But what?
Glaurung was a very powerful dragon, if not the most magical. According to Tolkien, he sired the rest of the dragon race, or at least the brood of Ur-Loki, wingless, fire-breathing dragons.
Wow. So, motherfucker. Brett knows
his
shit.
Well, you got me there, man.
But you kind of just blew my mind.
I can't read, but I know my shit.
Now I gotta look at these pictures again.
Pictures.
What use is a giant crawling lizard with no? What's a
well? He
with
can
no wings?
Fucking he can breathe fire and he can fuck with people's minds. What more do you need?
Yeah, but like in the fifth battle, like Iarondel has that epic battle with was it Ancalagon the Black? And I picture them fighting because they're both.
They do have wings.
They're in the sky.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So
they do have wings.
They have wings
then.
In a couple.
In
20 years,
them.
They get wings. All right.
He develops it.
Okay.
I'm telling you, he develops
it. No, you must be right. I just don't like it.
Right.
Why?
Because for 15 years, I've pictured Glaurung with wings. How did I just find out he didn't have wings?
Well, it's like an R&D thing. He just worked on it. What else was Morgoth doing? He's putting wings on dragons. Now, I always thought that, this is just my personal feelings, I don't think it's ever cleared up, but I always thought, like, because he couldn't create things, like maybe spirits just, he, like, almost like Maiar spirits, he placed them inside his things. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that, yeah, we kind of talked about that,
which
with,
is
like,
basically
the werewolves and
everything. The Balrogs and stuff like that.
So do you think, like, maybe Glaurung was a very powerful spirit that was in him, and Smaug was slightly less powerful? Is that, do you know what I'm saying? Or is this just all hypothetical?
Well, we don't know if they are, because we're talking about Huon and the werewolves, and like those, Huon was clearly like a Maya spirit, right? Or
yes, he was.
All right, because he could talk and everything. I figure if they're talking, they've got to be spirits.
Three whole times.
Still, he got to talk. But yeah.
So the eagles are just spirits?
I don't know. I mean, they talk about the evil spirits and the good spirits.
It makes sense to me that Manwe could put spirits in the eagles.
Yeah.
And then they could talk, because only like the head honchos talk.
Yeah,
and they
were
brothers.
His pets anyway.
Yeah. That sounds good to me.
I'll allow it.
So if Turin can kill Glaurung and Bard can kill Smaug, what does that mean?
I don't know. What does that mean?
I don't know. I'm just trying to see who's more powerful.
I think Turin is obviously more powerful.
Yeah. They just, the dragons both talk too much, and that was their downfall.
It wasn't talking that got Smaug killed. It was flying.
It was him.
If he hadn't flown, that belly would have been there.
Yeah, he still talked too much.
Yeah, but his...
He talked too much in the
Cumberbatch.
Movie.
Yeah, sidebar over. Dragons don't have wings, apparently. Thank you for messing with my brain.
Yeah,
I have to change
that
all those
sucks.
Sketches I did when I was 15 years old. I have to go change all that.
Just change their name.
All right. So meanwhile, we get to basically find out what Nienor and Morwen have been doing the whole time in part 6.
Wait a minute, are we on part 6? I thought we were on
part 5.
What? Did I skip a whole section? No.
Yep.
Oh god, we have so much to talk about. All right, part 5, Turin's journey to Dorloman, and then Turin's time in Brethel.
Wait, stop. I just want to reiterate to anybody who may be listening, you know, all three of you. Turin didn't do it. Like, Glaurung got him in a trance, and he didn't do anything as Morwen was just tramping. Like, not Morwen, Fyndulas just walked right by him, calling out his name, and he doesn't even remember that happening because of what the dragon was doing to him.
No, he does, I think, because
he does not remember it. No, he doesn't even remember Fyndulas.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure he doesn't even remember it.
Then why does he go after going to the Dorloman?
He goes after Fyndulas later because he meets up with someone who tells her to. I think Gwyndor, maybe, even.
No, it's
tells him
it's
there's
Mablung.
Still... Oh, Mablung? Yeah. Like, there's still time. You can try to save...
Okay.
And that's when he decides, I can either go for my mom, my sister,
like,
or go
stupid,
for... So Glaurung tells Turin that his mother and sister are thralls in Dorloman, so he flies back there and meets up with his old buddy Sador. Sador tells Turin that his mother and sister have fled south 4 or 5 years ago while the passes were safer thanks to the Black Sword, which is Turin. He also finds that an Easterling named Broda has taken his aunt Erin to wife. So he crashes the party, kills Broda and the rest of his company, and then Erin tells him to flee before his other extended family shows up for whatever reason. So he flees with a couple other bro slaves, and Erin torches the hall. Turin leaves Dorloman in search of his mother, sister, and Fyndulas. Turin is convinced that his mom and sister are probably safe in Doriath and that in the Girdle of Melian, so he decides to go for Fyndulas instead. All right, so pause here. So he must have known, right? Or did I mess up the summary again? So he must have known.
No, you probably didn't. I'm probably wrong.
All right.
I thought he did.
Like, excuse me. I actually wrote this one, so...
Oh, never mind.
Yes, he knew about Fyndulas. Like, he went to his family instead.
Okay.
I'm basing that on Children of Hurin and not...
Right, that's what I
No, you're probably right. But, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to...
Oh, no.
Anything.
I mean...
It's just you guys thought dragons had wings, so I just question everything you write now.
Fair enough.
My new house sigil is just going to be a pair of wings torn off a dragon's back, because apparently that's what I have to do now.
All right. You sadistic asshole.
During his tracking, he runs into some of Haleth's people, the woods people of Brethel. They're in a bad spot, so he totally pulls the old "I'm leading a great host of people" trick, where he makes a bunch of noise and then yells orders in the forest to trick the orcs, and they run away because they see his flaming sword and their pussies. So the men think that was pretty brilliant and ask him to join their group of bros.
Was his sword flaming?
Wasn't it flaming? They're like, there's like a weird brilliance.
I don't think so. Well, he did get it from Beleg, but that doesn't mean it was flaming.
Why do I think he has a flaming sword? No, I added that because I thought it was a flaming sword. Like a blue. In the illustration, it's flaming blue.
Well, the illustrations also have Gwyndor as a woman with two hands.
I'm going to get in touch with Ted Naismith about this. All right.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. Sword not flaming, dragons don't have wings, all of my... Everything the world's turned upside down.
I don't think it was flaming. It's black.
All right. So he basically tricks the orcs that were causing trouble for the people of Haleth, and he frees them from their trouble.
Oh, they say something really clever?
Probably.
Well, he said something.
He made a bunch of noise and was like, come on, men. And, like, the orcs were like, oh, shit, this guy's making a lot of noise. He must have, like, a big troop behind him.
Let's not stay and find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then, like, the people say something to him, like, oh, you must have really outpaced all your friends or something yeah. like that. Like,
oh, I don't have any friends.
Yeah.
Let's get out of here before they come back.
So the orcs, in their last, before they flee, they kill Finduilas and leave her pegged to a tree with a spear. So she's totally bummed and renames, Turin is totally bummed, renames himself Turimbar, Master of Doom, which is awesome. He then stays with the woodsmen and aids them in their attacks against the orcs and becomes a celebrity, soon elevating above their leader, a clubfoot named Brandir. Also puts down, he also puts down his sword and takes up the bow and spear because he's looking to move away from the recognizable Mormagil. So now he's with another band of people, which he will slowly destroy and cause shame and terror and death for. Which is
but because orcs he put to death.
But because he took up the black sword of Beleg, he's now named Mormagil, which is black sword, right?
Yeah.
He got that when he switched the sword over to his, like he changed it from Anglicel to Girthang.
Oh no, he was a black sword when he was a Nargothrond, because that's what the people even knew him as the black sword of the south, right?
Sure.
Now he's moving away from that. He doesn't want to be known.
He doesn't want to be that anymore. Yeah. So he's like, I'll take up a bow and spear.
But I mean, it was a very bittersweet reunion when he actually meets Sador again. And, you know, first he's, you know, doesn't know it's him. As the reader, you're pretty sure it's him. He just calls him an old man. And then he finally reveals him. But he's got, before he dies, he has a cool little line where he says, then he rested, leaning against a pillar, and the fire of his rage was as ashes. But old Sador crept up to him and clutched him about the knees, for he was wounded to the death. Thrice 7 years and more, it was long to wait for this hour, he said. But go now, go, Lord, go, and do not come back unless with greater strength. They will raise the land against you. Many have run from the hall. Go, or you will end here. Farewell. Then he slipped down and died. Really... poured one out for Sador there. He was maybe my favorite character of the whole series, even better than Turin. But I liked how yeah. he got to fight at the end. You know, the it's almost like Odysseus, you know, coming home and finding his house, you know, taken over, and then they burn the house down to cover the evidence.
Well, you know, he didn't get his chance to fight because he hurt himself. So this is like his chance to do his part.
Sador.
Or whatever. Sador, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was sweet that he's like, ah, I got to go out doing what I love, fighting. Mm-hmm. He's like, you've never fought before? I know.
No, I think he was in the battle, but he got wounded not fighting. Because he has that line about, like, I've seen my share of blood and guts, and that there's no...
Yeah, it was coming out of his leg when a tree hit him.
No, he fought. He was a soldier. He got wounded on leave. He was on leave. It was fine.
So, Turin kills everyone in Broda's house, which is...
Everybody pretty, but his aunt.
Right, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, he
it's
just
nice
walked in.
It's like a badass Lady Arryn to root for, too, which is... the first good Lady Arryn we hear of.
Just he walks in there, he's like, you guys have been fucking with my mom, right? All right.
All right. And he immediately cuts the head off of Broda.
Well, he does strike me as someone who goes from zero to, you know, 120 in 3 seconds. You know, Sador sat in the seat and he chucked a goblet at his face.
Well, they say early on that he's quick to anger, but also quick to pity.
Yeah, we don't get much of the pity, really, until the
end. Well, with Sador.
Right.
Yeah, that's the only time we get pity with him is through Sador. I guess Meme, he kind of pities.
He pities the petty?
Yeah, I mean, you have to. The last two.
Yeah, so now he's with the people of Brethel. I always felt bad for Brandir just because he's a clubfoot and he's lame, but he's probably the smartest guy in the village, but no one listens to him because he's wounded and you shouldn't listen to a cripple, apparently, in this world. But he kind of has the last laugh, you know, going forward, but still, I just wish...
No, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't. No, he's like the Mets.
No, he's the one that tells Turin that you screwed your sister.
And then he fucking kills him.
Yeah, but he got the line in before he died. He wasn't going to make it anyway.
Well, good for him.
He dropped the mic, and then he was stabbed in the face. So.
Wow, you got a weird idea of what's the last laugh.
That's true.
Just because Turin didn't laugh, that was why.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, he realized Glaurung was lying to him because his mom and sister, you know, weren't there. And then he flees south, and all that fun ensues. All right, so now on to section 6.
All right, let's do this. Meanwhile, back in Doriath, Morn hears about Turith and Nargothrond and its downfall and decides to go against Thingol's advice and leave Doriath to seek her son. In this decision, she is described as Fey, which is awesome because I don't even know what Fey is, but it's they use it a lot.
It's like...
I thought it was always angry and stubborn, and it's just I'm going to do this, whatever.
I thought Fae was under the influence of like crazy, like under the influence of fairy, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, giving an impression of vague unworldliness, having supernatural powers of clairvoyance. All right. Yeah, like there was something more going on. I don't know why.
I thought it was so much darker than that. That's a bummer. Fucking dragons have no wings and fae is.
Fae is also a musical artist born in 1973.
Oh, nice. So Thingol sends out some elves after Morwen to follow her and protect her, and they're led by Mablung because he's pretty awesome. All of a sudden, Nienor turns up, Turin's sister.
Wait, go back, read that sentence again.
Then all of a sudden, boom! Nienor, Turin's sister, was actually following everyone the whole time and shows up. And Mablung wants to turn back, but instead they keep on to Nargothrond. There the elves leave Morwen and Nienor to explore the caves. Well, guess who comes back? Glaurung. He scatters the company, and Morwen is lost, and Nienor finds herself on a hill having a chat with him. Him being Glaurung.
What are you doing here?
Come here often?
Once he finds out who she is, he puts an enchantment on her so she forgets everything, and that's when Mablung finds her. They start heading back, and when they're attacked by a band of orcs, and Nienor does the only sensible thing and runs away swiftly like a deer. A naked, naked deer.
What was I going to say?
Go ahead.
Oh, I like how Morwen notices that there's too many. She's like, no, there was like 20 and 9 before.
We don't know how to count yet.
She was just like yelling at them. She's like, no, there was 20 and 9, 20 and 9.
Does not compute.
And then when you say like a naked, naked deer, like if you rewind back to what the dude said to him, what was his name?
How the women run?
Yeah, they're they must run around like naked deer. And then
Saros was right.
Yeah, so finally she's spent and has a nice lie down on Findulus's grave.
I think that was dead on.
Anyone else have a better pronunciation?
Hauf and Elif?
Sure.
I like yours.
There she was found by the woodsman of Brethel, who fed her and gave her some clothes. But because she doesn't remember anything, she can't even talk. So they ask her questions and she just cries. Obviously, Turin then gives her the name Neniel, or Maid of Tears. So they took her home, like you do, and she immediately gets sick. Now, Brandir, the clubfoot, takes care of her during this time because he's got them skills. However, it's weird that she'll only stop moaning when Turin visits her.
Oh, buzzkill.
Right? Anyway, she gets better and starts to learn how to talk, and she's really interested in learning about the world around her now, and her darkness has passed. Brandir, the clubfoot, of course, has fallen in love with her, but she has fallen in love with Turin.
As the story goes.
But they do have the whole darkness thing in common, so they think they should get married. And Brandir is not happy. Besides loving Niniel, he's always thought there was something dark about Turin. And like a dick, he tells Niniel that Turinbar is actually Turin, son of Hurin. And she doesn't know what that effing means. But a shadow comes on her, and she calls off the wedding for another year. Finally, Turin is like, dude, do you want this? But it's like this. Either we get married and I hang up my sword, or I pick it up only to protect us, or we don't and I go on warring. So they marry at Midsummer and happy, and their happiness brings a bigger shadow on the heart of Brandir, the clubfoot. So to sum it up, due to the changing in names and all, Turin has married his sister and is probably plowing her on the reg, because guess who's pregnant?
Sissy's pregnant. It's too bad that was such a bad thing. Yeah. It could have been great together.
I really did appreciate it where Mablung is like kind of washes his hands of the whole like, I'm done trying to help you guys, because he's like, truly, it is by lack of counsel, not of courage, that Hurin's kin brings woe to others. And then he's got the other line about, fail you both, and foolhardy. Like, he's just, I can't take it anymore. You're making the worst decisions. I'm trying, you know, me and Beleg have been trying to make you see sense, bring you home, and then Niniel just wants to run away, and, oh, it's just one bad thing after the other. So he does say it pretty well, like, you're all making bad decisions. This is not going to end well.
It's almost like after Hurin, they just started making bad decisions as a group, the family.
Yeah, he says, even so with Turin, yet not so with his fathers. But now they are all fey, and I like it not. More do I dread this errand of the king than the hunting of the wolf. What is to be done? I just picture him writing dispatches back to Thingol, like, I can't do this anymore. Send me somewhere else.
And the hunting of the wolf is...
pretty bad.
That was the wolf that ate the Silmaril, right?
Yeah, that was Karkaroth.
That was going batshit crazy. And they're like, we gotta kill this. I wasn't here for that one.
And that is not as bad as this. So yeah, he does the whole Oedipus thing. And I can just picture Tolkien like, ah, oh, so clever. Well, it's the most obvious connection he's ever done.
Well, to us, but... Oh, the Oedipus connection.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so Summer, as that ended, he's banging his sister, and she gets pregnant, and then Glaurung is moving, you know, he's destroyed Nargothrond, he hung out there, as dragons do, just sitting on their piles of gold, but then he decides to head east, because he knows that that's where Turin is, and all his... He's basically like... He must have had a 9-step plan, and he's on step 7, and all right, everything's good, like, I've sent him there, I've sent her there, now I'm gonna go meet him and fuck everything up. So that's what he thinks is coming.
Who has a 9-step plan?
Dragon, Glaurung, you know, he's got to fool this guy to thinking this, and then blank her memory and use the Men in Black red thingy, and she forgets that. And
it's almost
and number
too
nine
convoluted
is,
to
gotta
believe.
Gotta get me some wings.
Yes.
Right? But, you know, his plan is so, like,
convoluted.
Involved.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And then they, like, say somewhere that is like, oh, he's done Morgoth, exactly what Morgoth told him to. It's like, Morgoth fucking planned that shit out ahead of time?
He's moving at, like, you know, 19 chess moves ahead.
Yeah.
If he is. Like.
Well, I get that he's really intelligent. I'm fine with that. Not intelligent enough to not drop his belly down on that sword, though. Sorry. Getting ahead.
It's a big belly. He can't control it. All right.
Hey, I'm starting to get that problem, so.
It's a dad bod. Do you have a kid?
Sure, oh, somewhere.
Oh, good for you, Matt. Dodged a bullet there.
Ooh.
The girlfriend just keeps telling me that, like, she's not telling me that dad bod is in for her, but she said, it's a big thing, dad bod's in. I'm like, I'm never going to have a dad bod, so get used to not seeing it.
Are you apologizing for being in fit condition?
God damn it.
Well, I have a very feminine-like physique, so not like breasts. I'm not like Gwyneth.
And you do have two hands as well, which helps.
I do, in fact. And three dogs and two cats.
And a brown chicken and a brown cow?
No, those don't actually... exist. Oh. Let's just pretend. That's for podcast alone. All right, sorry. Let's get back to it. I'm just wasting our time.
I have to read a 9-page summary here, and then we can finish this damn thing.
Good luck. You got this.
All right. This is the last part. Time passes, and increasingly the servants of Morgoth are heading towards Brethil, but Turin said he wouldn't fight unless to protect his wife Niniel, until finally the orcs overcome the hunters, and Dorlas, another warrior, begs Turin to help them, and he does. The Black Sword turns the orc invasion, but draws the attention of Glaurung. Turin's success makes him a leader in the group, usurping Brandir the Clubfoot. So they find the dragon is coming for Brethil, and Turin devises a plan to attack while Brandir counsels otherwise. Dorlas immediately volunteers to go with Turin, and also makes fun of Brandir for being crippled puss. Hunthor, kin to Brandir, volunteers to go in Brandir's stead. He's like, you know, my cousin, it's cool, he's smart, you're not listening, I'm gonna go, and I'm gonna stand in for him. And doesn't he, like, fall off a cliff in, like, 5 seconds anyway? Niniel begs Turin not to go, but he's like, there's nowhere to hide, we gotta get this dragon. And that's actually true, because they're literally running out of space on the map of, like, where Morgoth doesn't control. So it's pretty much just, like, this forest and the south. So they get to the river Teiglin, which is surrounded by a deep ravine. Turin explains that they're gonna stab Glaurung in the belly as he tries to go from one side to the other. Which makes no sense, since he can fly, but whatever. All right, so apparently...
Which he can't.
He can't
so
do.
Now it makes sense. God damn it.
This is still blowing my mind constantly. I can picture the Tolkien professor like, how did you not know that Glaurung didn't fly? Ruff, ruff, ruff. Anyway.
He was like a Balrog, blah, blah, blah.
Well, the Balrog at least had vestigial wings, because he was like cloaked in darkness, as all those lines about how he was wing-shaped, so he definitely...
Vestigial wings of
well,
shadow.
I don't care if he had wings or not, but the argument is he put his shadow out as if wings,
okay.
Is what it says.
Yeah, that's still debatable, though.
I know means. It is. I'm not arguing either way, because I don't really care.
In the movie, he had wings.
And he looked badass in the movie,
so
I'm willing to take that as canon.
All right. Dorlas sees the height of the ravine, and the thought of climbing in the dark really doesn't sound like something he would like to do. Meanwhile, Niniel is tired of waiting and wants to see what's happening, even though Preggers, she sets out, with lots of people of Brethil to see what happened. Then Brandir is just like, fuck it, you guys don't listen to me at all. I'm not your lord anymore. Don't ask me to heal you, because I won't. Done. He grabs his crutch. He grabs his...
Grabs his crotch.
He grabs his crotch
grabs
and
his
says,
narwhal.
You. Then he grabs his crutch and sword and sets out to find Niniel. Meanwhile, back at the ravine, Dorlas totally pussies out, but Hunthor goes with Turin to the other side so they can climb up and stab Glaurung in the belly. The dragon is spitting fire everywhere, and Turin almost falls due to the heat, but Hunthor does him a solid and catches him. Just as Turin was done thanking him, a rock falls on Hunthor's head. Bummer. So he goes it alone and stabs the dragon in the belly. Glaurung's death throes were pretty violent, and then he lay at the bottom of the ravine, still breathing but dying. So Turin goes down to check on him and gloats over his enemy, then pulls out the sword, and some dragon blood splashes onto his hand, and he passes out, because dragon blood is magical. Niniel finally gets to the ravine with Brandir hobbling behind her. She sees Turin and despairs, but goes down to tend his hand and calls out to him. This wakes up Glaurung one last time, and he does a great last fuck you to Niniel. Hail, Nienor, daughter of Húrin. We meet again ere we end. I give you joy that you have found your brother at last, and now you shall know him. Stab her in the dark, treacherous to foes, faithless to friends, and a curse unto his kin. Turin, son of Húrin, but worst of all his deeds, you shall feel in yourself. Bam. Oh, yeah. There's a whole other paragraph.
Well, he, like, lets
we'll
her...
We'll talk now, yeah.
He lets her see, like, remember her past now, too, because
yeah,
she didn't even remember.
He removes the glamour, and basically it all comes flooding back to her.
And she's like, the fuck?
Yeah. Another, I love Brandir so much, he just gets such a bad... I picture him breaking his stick, he's like, fuck you people, and then more bad crap.
It's like, damn it, I needed that.
Yeah, he breaks his staff off.
I'll just grab my crotch instead.
Well, you know, as one does. And then we get into the full Romeo and Juliet ending. Let me just finish this. With the dragon dead, whose spell lifted and she remembered everything and the truth behind the dragon's words set in, and she goes a bit mad because gross. Brandir tries to calm her, but instead she throws herself from the top of the ravine into the raging river. Now things really unravel. Brandir finds Dorlas being a pussy, and Dorlas tries to kill Brandir, but Brandir, the clubfoot, kills him with the short sword he brought with him. Turin wakes up, sees that his hand has been bandaged, and wonders about this. Brandir then drops some knowledge on Turin. Niniel is dead. Niniel is Nienor, the daughter of Húrin. Yup, that Húrin. Turin calls bullshit and kills Brandir. And then Brandir dies, saying he wishes to be with Nienor on the other side of the sea. Which is
while
pretty
giggling.
Sweet. Yeah. Turin then runs wildly into the woods, because that's the coping mechanism in this story, and runs into Maplung, who says he's been seeking Nienor and Morwen, and basically confirms Brandir's story. Turin then goes to Cabin and Arras, which is the cliff where the Nienor jumped off of, the place where Nienor jumped. He pulls out his sword and asked if it would kill him. Yeah, he asked his sword if it would kill him. And the blade rang a cold voice in answer, yes, I will drink your blood, that I may forget the blood of Beleg, my master, and the blood of Brandir slain unjustly. I will slay you swiftly. So yeah, there's a talking sword. Later on, Cabot and Arras, a stone was erected reading, Turin Turimbar Dagnir Glaurunga, Nienor Nienel, which we'll translate later. At this stone, Morwen would later meet Húrin, who had been released by Morgoth. Morwen then dies, and that place is known as Tol Morwen.
That's a nice tease. Yeah. Keep them around till the end.
Both of them. All right.
So, Glaurung too fat to fly? Because I thought he had wings.
Me too.
Why would he slither over?
Yeah. All these show notes were done before Brett dropped his knowledge on us, so we just had to keep reminding ourselves of that. It kind of reminded me of Romeo and Juliet, you know, where he wakes up and then she thinks he's dead, so she kills himself, and then the other... Yeah. So then, basically, it kind of ends like that.
Yeah, but like you said, meets Oedipus. Yeah.
I really... Oh, here it is. I really like what Niniel said when she left him. Let's see if I can find the actual quote. Oh, yeah. Farewell, O twice beloved. And I'm not going to say the other part because I'll never be able to say it. Master of Doom by Doom Mastered. Oh, happy to be dead. And then she goes and kills herself. I just like the farewell, O twice beloved. I think that's cool because it's like she loved him as a brother and as a mate. And it's a neat way to say it. It's a very poetic way to say it for somebody who's about to jump off a cliff.
Yeah, it's also pretty creepy. Kind of like ties everything up.
They should have just gone all Targaryen, just let it roll. I don't know why she had to kill herself for that. Well, she thought he was dead. That's right.
Yeah. It was weird that like there was such a buildup and then all this stuff happens over the course of a parrot. You know, I picture like Brandir running down, the townspeople are behind him, and then everyone's lying to everybody, but they're also dropping truth bombs. It's just really weird the way it all just comes down and then it's done. And then you get the whole like epilogue with Húrin being released, and Morwen shows up, and they name it after Morwen because that's where Morwen dies, but it's where her kids died. It's super sad.
And then it's the only place in Beleriand to survive the flood. Like, it's the only place that's above the water.
It does become Tol Morwen, because Tol is island, but I don't know if that's canon, because it was confirmed, it was like in one of the...
It's in the Silmarillion.
No, but there's other, apparently Dorthonion, like, because Dorthonion was raised, that survived as like a big island also, but it's only referenced in like the histories of Middle-earth, so I wasn't sure if it was the only place that survived, but they do say that it did survive until the breaking of the world.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's weird, because the world isn't even like that. It must have had, like, an earthquake, and it must have shot up.
Yeah.
Because this isn't clearly isn't the highest place.
Right. So that is the sad story of Niniel and Turin and his weird family. But from this, we get Tor and everything that comes then. So, like, I feel like Tor got the long end of the stick, at least. Less.
I don't know, because Turin's the one that they talk about later on. Like, oh, elf friends, Turin, Turimbar. Yeah, right.
Yeah, but, like, the savior of Beleriand comes from Tor and his side.
With Beleriand?
Idril? Is that her name?
Oh, his wife is Idril, yeah. And then their kid is Earendil.
Right.
Which, you know, gives the prophecy that Star will come from both our houses, that Hoar says right before he dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is neat that they... I mean, I know, like, I've heard that the Earendil story is, like, the first story he ever wrote.
Well, the story he wrote, Earendil was a character related. In it, but it was he took the name Earendil from, like, a 7th century poem just because he liked the sound of it. But, like, I don't think he had it all worked out who Earendil actually was.
I think he was, like, a captain of a flying ship or something, which is what he did.
Right, but, like, he hadn't built his whole mythology and everything.
Right. But I feel like it was, like, it's just interesting that he had that in his head before he even started this and just, like, worked it in.
Yeah.
Because you can. It's your own shit. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, that's what Tolkien took joy in, was reworking stuff and, you know, fitting it into his greater work.
Whether it fit or not.
Yes.
Now the sun rises from the other direction for no reason whatsoever.
And then it didn't. It was just for like half a chapter. It was fine.
I know.
But we can blame that on Christopher, so that's fine. Closing thoughts or comments on where we are. So basically, at this point, the fifth battle happened. Things are not looking too good for men, and like the survivors are basically pretty much just Doriath at this point, right? And Curdan down by the shore.
And Gondolin.
Oh, that's right. Gondolin is... But now...
We still have the fall of Gondolin.
Morgoth kind of knows where Gondolin is. He just doesn't know exactly where it is.
Right. He knows the area, but he doesn't know how to get there.
Right. Because he released Hurin, and Hurin, like, goes and, like, yells at the mountains, like, why?
Like a dumbass.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Hurin does a couple of dumbass things, but...
Well, Turgon's just like, no, my heart's closed to him. No. I told him not to come back.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about the Naglamir... And Hurin, and the fall of Doriath, I think, and the fall of Gondolin in the next Silmarillion cast, right?
Yeah, because before it can get better, it has to get a whole lot worse.
All right. Yeah, we were just like, and that's the end. That's kind of the way you feel when the story ends. You're like, wait a minute, that's it? They both killed each other, and then the mother killed herself? What the fuck?
Well, I feel like... because you don't feel like that in Lord of the Rings, where it's much more, the characters are so more developed and there's much more world building and you know, there's just more text, but it just feels like you never really, I never really knew the characters, you know, so I didn't, not that I didn't care when they died, but like I cared more about the minor, like I cared more about Sador and about Brandir than I did about Turin, because it's just all these hits. You don't get the subtlety, you just get this happened, and I just, it's not a bad thing, it's just, it's different writing than the Lord of the Rings, and we know that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and like especially compared to the Silmarillion's like version of it, like the Children of Hurin obviously is way expanded.
Yeah.
So like you get to know the characters a little more.
You get to know the minor characters a little more, but Turin, he's pretty much
the story,
fleshed out.
Yeah, there's not much. It's just more. I mean, the text isn't that much more. There's just a lot of illustrations. I mean, I know it's expanded, but it's not like nothing really was changed. It was just expanded a little bit.
I feel like in the Silmarillion, it's just like Turin changing his name every few fucking
pages.
Yeah.
And he doesn't evolve as a character at all, really. I mean, he stays the same. Like, his personality stays the same. He has revelations, but it's more about stuff that happened, not like, you know, he never changes. You know, if he changed, he wouldn't have killed Brandir, or he wouldn't have done the things he did in done the same thing every place he goes to, rising high, being a dick, causing trouble, and then fucking off.
Yeah. And when they say, like, he's quick to anger and quick to pity, they should just say, Turin doesn't think before he acts. That's pretty much what it is. He's quick to do everything because he doesn't even think. He's just like, this is what I got to do next.
And it's even worse when you see it from an elf's point of view, who are, like, used to being these very thoughtful, reflective people taking time. And then when they just see him do this, it's like, what the hell? How do you just go from 0 to 60? And why did you drive Saros off a cliff? He was just making a joke.
Well, he wasn't making a joke. He was trying to kill him.
Yeah, but he couldn't have actually killed him.
What, Saros?
Yeah. He was like a flute-playing ninny.
He ambushed him in full armor, and Turin was just walking down a road.
All right. I'll allow it. That's fine.
I don't even think Turin was armed.
No,
he kills him with
either.
His sword, yeah.
His own sword, and he's like poking him in the ass. He didn't kill him with his sword. Yeah. That dude jumped to his death because he thought he was going to kill him with his sword. He's like, I'll take the jump. It's like, you're an idiot. And then Turin turns around and everybody's watching him. He's like, that's not what it looked like. I gotta go.
Yeah. Cannot stay and talk. Run. But we will continue next time. Thank you for joining us. Good night.
All right. Good night, guys.
Good night.
Listen to me and you shall hear. News has not been this 1,000 years. Heresies and many more. You never heard the like before. Holidays are despised, new fashions are devised. Oh, Christmas is kicked out of town. Yet let's be content and the times lament. You see the world turned upside down.
Boom!
Boom!
Holy shit, I just got attacked by a giant green bug out on my porch.
Ah. Was it a dragonfly?
No, dude, it was like a green bird. I swear to God, it was huge. Okay, right. Anyway, I flew away. That's nice.
Dinosaurs in Massachusetts.
It is known.
Boom!
Boom!
All right, let's not get bogged down on the six packs of angels. That'll be a different podcast. All right, so...
Sign me up.
You're already there, buddy.
Boom!
Boom!
Brett, do you want to read this recap? It's two really big paragraphs, but you can divide it up, or you can read both
Jesus,
of them if you
man,
want.
Man, you sure? I'm not a very good out loud reader.
Well, I don't want to read them all.
Sound out the words, man. It's okay.
After. All right.
For God's sakes, man! It says, "Welcome to Snake's Bend."
Boom!
Boom! A little later on, Turin rescue. A little later on, Turin. Is that what it's supposed to say?
A little later on.
Oh! Turin. Later on's not one word? There we go. A little later on, Turin rescues a woman who was fleeing.
Wait, later on is not one word. That would be a weird
word. No, I know
word.
It's not. I was just...
Okay.
I can't read, so... And I hadn't memorized that word yet. So... A little later on... Jesus, I feel like there should be a comma there.
What, a little later?
There should be a
comma. No, a little later on, comma, Turin rescues a woman. No?
No, that doesn't sound right either. Anyway, continue.
A little later on, Turin rescues a woman who is fleeing from... You're going to edit this, right?
Nope.
Fucker.
Boom!
Boom!
I like to beat on elves, because I'm a dick.
Goddamn.
Now I'm just picturing a dwarf beating Beleg, like... Meh, meh, meh. So, all right, we'll get past that.
Does Beleg have a Norwal tattoo?
Bringing it all back around.
Oh, God.
Boom!
Boom! Beleg's sword, Girthang, you gotta stop moving it, dude.
Sorry.
Blackity blick duck black fucker.
Just continue.
Boom.
Boom.
It's all right, Brett. I remember my first time podcasting, too.